Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. You're here for the special flower celebration in which we honor the diversity of our wonderful fellowship. Whether you're a flower with petals of any color, you're welcome. If you're a hothouse hybrid flower and you grew up in a greenhouse, or if you're a so-called weed and you grew up by a railroad track, you're welcome here too. And whatever kind of flower you are and whatever kind of flowers you love to be with, you're welcome here. I'm going to light the chalice, which is symbolic of us being truth seekers. And we recognize that truth can be found anywhere, from a rock, a cloud, a slug, or any person of any age or stature. Song of the Flower, number 23. I am a kind word uttered and repeated by the voice of nature. I'm a star fallen from the blue tent upon the green carpet. I'm the daughter of the elements with whom winter conceived, to whom spring gave birth. I was reared in the lap of summer, and I slept in the bed of autumn. At dawn, I unite with the breeze to announce the coming of light. At evening tide, I join the birds in bidding the light farewell. My plains are decorated with my beautiful colors, and the air is scented with my fragrance. As I embrace slumber, the eyes of night watch over me, and as I awaken, I stare at the sun, which is the only eye of the day. I drink dew for wine, and hearken to the voices of the birds, and dance to the rhythmic swaying of the grass. I am the lover's gift. I am the wedding wreath. I am the memory of a moment of happiness. I am the last gift of the living to the dead. I am a part of joy and a part of sorrow. But I look up high to see only the light and never look down to see my shadow. This is wisdom which man must learn. And now we'll sing, as you are able, stand up, please, hymn number 305.
Showers all the colors.
No one gave me any special announcements. So, joys and concerns? Does anyone have some joys they'd like to report or concern in their life? Oh, here comes the mic.
Hi, Jim Chanteau. On Friday, I, for the first time in 6 months, was able to drive myself somewhere. Last November, as many of you know, I had a seizure. And the laws in Kansas are such, if you have a seizure, you can't drive for 6 months. In the meantime, you can't have another. Well, fortunately, I didn't have another. But it felt really strange to be behind the wheel of a car again. And I wanted to thank all the people here that had given me rides to various places over that six-month period I couldn't drive, including Dick and Judy Cattell, Elkie Lorenz, Michael Oldfather, Bryce Holbrook. Who have I missed? Oh, and Ann Martian, who gave me rides everywhere. Thanks so much.
Okay. Zach, my son, wants to tell everybody that his mom, my wife, Mayumi, is going to come about a week from now, finally got her visa to come to the U.S. So after
great.
A year and a half.
Hello, good morning. I actually have a sadness to share. I learned last week that an old, longtime friend of mine in Wichita had been killed on Thursday evening. So we've had kind of a grieving week, but it's good to be here today.
Any more joys or concerns? Well, I have a joy. My youngest daughter, Chloe, is here visiting, and I'm thrilled to see her. And she loves flowers, too. And now, time for a story.
Story time, story time.
Exhaustion. Do you guys like flowers? Oh, what? Do you have a favorite flower? Does anyone have a favorite flower? What if you were a flower, what would you be?
A mixed breed that isn't discovered yet.
Oh, a mystery flower. There probably are lots of flowers that haven't been discovered yet. But you are like a flower, and we're slowly discovering you as you change every day, every minute. In fact, this whole program is about all of you and all of these flowers in our congregation. We're all so different. Like, did you see all the flowers everyone bought in the entryway? And these are some, most of these are from our little Unitarian gardens around our building. They're so varied, even the ones that are of the same type, like these two purple clovers, they're different. And this whole program today is to celebrate our differences. And when you go home today, everyone should take a different flower than they came with. If you didn't bring a flower, that's fine. We have lots to share. And that's to show that we accept each other how we are. Each of us has something unique to offer, no matter who we are, and we all learn from each other. Do you guys know the parts of a flower? Some of the parts? What's this part called? Right, the petal. And this part? The stem. And some of them have this funny little green thing underneath the flower. Oh, here's one. It's a little rose. See the? Do you know what you call those little green leaves underneath? There are special leaves. They are leaves. They're called sepals. And in the middle of the flower, do you know the names of those funny-looking parts? Oh, a bud. It's a baby flower. And see this? What's this one called that gets powder on your fingers? Sometimes yellow, sometimes purple. That's called pollen. And that's on the male, the boy part of the flower. That's called the anther. And see this one funny one sticking out really far? That's the female part of the flower. That's the girl part. And if you touch it, it's sticky on the tip. And some flowers are pollinated by wind. Like, do you know what this is? Well, I think it's brome, but...
It's brome.
Oh, okay. And if you look really closely at it, I'll point it, I'll pass it around. It doesn't have flashy petals. The grasses are wind pollinated. The wind blows their pollen around. They don't have petals, but they have these anthers with pollen on them. You can see them sticking out if you look at them really close. Flowers look kind of fragile and weak, don't they?
I'm not fragile and weak. I'm strong.
What do you mean you're strong?
I went through the big storm, and here I am. I bend with the wind, and I'm still fine. A lot of big trees went over, but not me.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I command armies.
Armies? What are you talking about?
Armies of bees and butterflies and animals that come to me to spread my pollen far and wide around the world so that I can grow in many different places.
That's strange. Did you know that a flower commanded armies of insects and other creatures? Leah says they don't technically command them, but those insects carry the pollen away.
But I do. I give them a teeny tiny treat of nectar. Not too much. I don't want to spoil them. I want them to visit lots of flowers and spread my pollen around.
Okay. I guess you are pretty powerful.
And I can make people do things, too.
Oh, come on. Can a flower make you do anything, do you think?
Sneeze.
Yeah. Hot jokes on you.
Well, how do you mean you can command people around?
Well, we're beautiful and we smell good. And that makes you want to plant us, which makes us move all different new places. We're going to take over the world someday.
Well, I see a rose has just appeared on the stage here. Do you have something to say about what it means to have a name that's a flower? Does it influence you in anywhere to like flowers or otherwise? Have you ever had a special garden? What's going to be in your garden?
Strawberries, blackberries, and possibly some flowers.
See, flowers are into everything.
Well, don't forget when you leave today to take flower home with you and to remind you of all the flowers in our fellowship. Does anyone have anything to say about a nice flower garden that they've had or some seeds they planted? Well, okay, you can tell stories in your class. Thank you. Now, time for the offertory. Give as you are able. We give in many ways besides monetary. Thank you, Renee. In a biological sense, flowers are all about sex. Some plants spread their pollen by wind or water, but others are master manipulators. They lure pollinators with small nectar rewards, aromas that mimic attractive foodstuffs, a secure resting place, or forms, colors, and patterns that mimic potential mates. The prizes that flowers offer are not enough to satiate, so that pollinators are forced to make visits to multiple flowers, spreading pollen around and promoting genetic diversity. But just how do flowers enlist people as plant propagators? What attracts people to flowers? In his book, The Botany of Desire, Michael Pollan describes a theory suggested by some evolutionary psychologists. They postulate that humans, who have been foragers for 99% of their time on Earth, have been naturally selected for their attraction to flowers as predictors of future sources of food. They reason that a human who could readily predict the location of a future source of food would have an advantage over someone who could only blunder by chance into a cache of fruit. This intriguing idea, however, will remain unprovable until certain genes are identified for human preferences. For people, the symbolic value of flowers has also come to be significant. In many cultures in ancient times and today, celebrate spring with flower festivals. The luscious vibrance of flowers enhances happy occasions, but flowers are prominently displayed at sad occasions as well. Anthropologists believe that the remains of flowers and pollen found in 60,000-year-old Neanderthal graves, along with layers of colored clay and remnants of necklaces fashioned from bird claws, were intentionally placed with the dead. Before embalming became a common practice in Western culture, fragrant flowers in abundance were used to mask the smell of decomposition. Our association of flowers with life and vitality signify hope and renewal when we are sad. A presentation of flowers to a grieving person can express a sympathy too difficult to express in words and honors the deceased with his preciousness. Flowers, with their guise of innocence and purity, have also played a part in the protest of authoritarianism and war machines, as when Vietnam-era hippies poked daisies into soldiers' rifle barrels, or when present-day Ukrainians routinely stuff bouquets into Soviet display cannons. A flower often appears fragile, frilly, unsubstantial. We can appear the same, or at least feel that way inside, but a flower, like us, has great resilience to harsh external elements. Though tattered, it can leave behind a significant legacy in the form of a seed, just as we can leave behind, when we die, the seeds and fruits of our life's labors, a groundwork for others to build on, inspiring deeds, words, or students, even if we sire no offspring. A flower's passage from bud to unfolding bloom to full form to wilted ghost is a fast-forward symbolism of the life cycle. Today, we replicate the flower celebration developed in 1923 by the Czechoslovakian Unitarian minister Norbert Fabian Čapek to honor the diversity of his congregation in Prague. Many of us have brought flowers from our gardens to represent the diverse beauty of our UU fellowship. Several human flowers from our UU bouquet will share with you their flower stories.
Good morning. Everyone here must enjoy flowers. Is that why you're here? What happens when somebody gives you a bouquet of flowers or a plant? Do you smile? Do you express gratitude? They actually did research at Rutgers University, University of New Jersey. They explored the link between flowers and life satisfaction in a 10-month study. I don't think it'd take me that long to figure that out, but anyway, the results show that flowers are a natural and healthful moderator of moods. Imagine that. Flowers have an immediate impact on happiness. It said all study participants, young, old, any race, express extraordinary delight and gratitude. The reaction was universal. That was their first finding. The second finding, that not only Do you like receiving them? They have a long-term effect on your mood. It flowers leave you feeling less depressed, anxious, and agitated, and people would demonstrate a higher sense of enjoyment and life satisfaction. And third, they found that flowers make intimate connections. The presence of flowers led to increased contact with family and friends. And they found that just having flowers in your office or on your desk or whatever, that people tended to be friendlier and more apt to engage in conversation and feel more at ease because you had flowers there. So now common sense tells us that flowers make us happy, and now we have science to back us up. So everyone here today will receive flowers when they leave, and we hope that everyone will be happy when they leave and feel gratitude.
Well, I'm not Iris Kingery, as it says in your program, but I am her mother. My name's Katie. Iris is a shy flower, and sometimes the ability to speak in front of people leaves her quite suddenly. So she asked me if I would speak for her. Her name is Iris, and over the years, I have a terrible confession to make. I often feel annoyed when people think she's named after a flower. What was I thinking, right? Of course people will think she's named after a flower, but I have to tell you that when I was considering the word Iris for her name, I was thinking about the eye. I was thinking about the aperture that lets in light. And I started to read about Iris, who was the messenger of the gods in Greek mythology. There's a beautiful Rodin sculpture, Rodin the sculptor from the 19th century, a sculpture called Iris, Messenger of the Gods. Look up a picture of it sometime if you haven't seen it. It's very flower-like and evocative in all the ways you talked about flowers a moment ago. So as she was preparing to come and we were thinking about words that we loved, a word, Iris, which also means rainbow in many different languages, this seemed very powerful to me. And it wasn't really till after she was born that I started to read about the flowers, which I love. They're lovely. Their irises are wonderful. And I guess they're named irises because of the many colors that irises grow in, like the colors of the rainbow. The word iridescent comes from the same root. And going back to that analogy to rainbow, if you speak Spanish, arco de iris, there's that iris is through every reference to rainbow. So I hope as she grows older, she'll realize what a beautiful name she has, flower or not flower, whatever the meaning is.
Good morning. What is the source of our attraction to flowers? Whether they're real and they look artificial, or they're artificial and they look real, whether they're painted, this bromeliad, whether they're painted, picked, or planted, worn, distilled, or eaten, is it the colors, the fragrances, the forms, the patterns, or even the symbolism? I'd like to ask everyone here to close your eyes for a minute, fill your lungs deeply with air, and imagine a cloudless, eternal blue sky. When I say the word flower, what appears? Which one of the estimated 300,000 to 400,000 species of flowers do you see as the archetypal flower? In one of my earliest childhood memories, I'm sitting on the ground beside a flower bed, gazing at a blossom in a long moment of amazed reverence in the spell of what Richard Dawkins defines as poetic magic. In his book, The Magic of Reality, poetic magic is differentiated from supernatural magic or stage magic. It is the moving, exhilarating connection, the source of goosebumps that must have been the beginning of my love of flowers. Years later, as a stay-at-home mom,
I rediscovered this amazement as I learned to grow plants indoors under artificial light and at my windows. A seed packet, a sprinkle of seeds like dust. In a few weeks, a pinpoint of green. In months, a bud. Then a flower I'd never seen before. This was a way to explore the world from my home. I discovered the North American Rock Gardening Society plant catalog with its listings of 6,000 seeds from different species sent by people from every corner of the world. One spring, I counted 600 packets of seeds I was attempting to put in these little six packs to try to grow, with the only reward of watching the magic unfold. But what was this attraction or obsession? I have a theory. Current science indicates that we share 60% of our genes with insects. What does a rose smell like to a bee? Their organs of smell are called sensilla, and they're on the ends of their antenna. It must be a totally different experience for them to smell a rose. The soap tree yucca has a fragrance that attracts only one species of moth. Through the long, slow dance of geologic time, these species have arisen around each other, helping each generation survive into the next season. The wonder of this understanding is the basis of our seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of existence of which we are a part. My theory is that at some subliminal level in our brains, 60% of our attraction for flowers comes from our inner bee, buzzing busily that seeing flowers means plants, and that means food energy and the survival of life on Earth. So we will continue to offer each other the flowers, as evidence shows Neanderthals, as you said, in the dawn of our human beginnings did, flowers to show love, reverence, sympathy, forgiveness, hopes for health, and farewells at the end of life. I hope as we all exchange flowers this morning, we have thoughts of gratitude for our loving community and awe for our amazing world.
Well, I'm definitely more of a weed, so thank you for welcoming the weeds today. Appreciate that. I've always felt like a weed growing between the two slabs of concrete, you know? You know those really strong weeds? The kind that you spray vinegar on and they just come back? That's the kind of weed I feel like. So I want to talk with you today about the dandelion because I find it to be a very powerful symbol in my life. The reason that I find it to be so powerful is it's hard to think of a more ubiquitous weed, isn't it? I believe it's called Taxascum officinale. And officinale denotes the fact that it's had many uses over time. So even though it's a very prized plant in human history, if you imagine yourself walking in downtown Manhattan and you walk past a planting bed and you see dandelions, I just want you to dwell on that for a second and somebody tell me their kind of gut reaction to that dandelion. Yes? So don't herbicide me. Nobody herbicide me here. So those dandelions, they keep coming back because they have a really powerful, strong taproot, and they are perennial plants. And anybody who has a dandelion digger, which I do, right here, I probably have three dandelion diggers. I'm impressed with Anna that she could dwell on the idea of seeing those dandelions in the planting beds downtown, which is her neighborhood, and still feel positive. Because I'm going to admit to you, especially if I'm walking past a landscape that I've helped a community make, when I see those dandelions, my first reaction really isn't to think about all the depth of them. My first reaction is to think, it looks like no one's caring for that. It looks like someone has fallen down on the job. It looks like, for some reason, we're not doing what we should right there. I was just working in the meadow last week, and I did find myself pulling some dandelions. I want to take you to a different place in your mind now. The place is Poland, You're in the Polish countryside. There's no cell phones ringing. And I want you to imagine you're looking out over a large open field. In the distance is a line of trees, a gentle kind of arc of forest. And in that green field, it's just a carpet of yellow polka dots, fuzzy yellow polka dots. You see that all over in Poland, or so I'm told by my Polish friend, because the dandelion really is viewed differently there. They make a honey substitute called May honey from dandelion flowers, a sugar substitute. And as you might know, every part of the dandelion is useful. I bet everyone here has had sautéed dandelion greens at some point in their life, and they are delicious. I understand with our global climate changes and coffee becoming more scarce, which will kill me, that will be bad for me, but I understand that dandelion root roasted and ground is a lovely coffee substitute, so I'm planning to start trying that when I want to kill dandelions. Interestingly, you know, and if you were out there quietly thinking, yeah, that dandelion would bother me too, well, I'm with you there. And a lot of people are. Apparently we spend over $35 billion a year in the landscape industry on herbicides. $35 billion industry in our nation. We apply, as homeowners, we apply over 90 million pounds of herbicide every year. And some of that obviously ends up in our water sources. We're led to believe that our regulatory agencies are so robust and perfect that we're being protected from any dangers of these chemicals. But there's a lot of evidence that that's really not true. So when I look at the dandelion and I think of all the hatred it arises in those who want a perfect lawn, and yet if we just cross to another continent and view a beautiful, expansive field, it shows me that I need to work a little bit on changing preconceptions that lead to something being hated almost irrationally, like the dandelion. It was one of you here that said, and it's the softest flower, when I mentioned dandelion. And I had never thought of that, but it is the softest flower. It's a wonderful velvety thing, the dandelion. So as you leave and you go to your landscape today, and maybe you were going to dig some dandelions, go ahead. I'm not saying to stop that, but eat part of it after you do. Use part of that plant.
Good morning. Boy, we're already so full of so much to think about, but this is just going to keep building. You know, my portion is why your ass is grass, and we'll get to that in a minute. But first, I want to pass around. Sylvia has a tray, and I have a little bowl here that's serving as a tray, and we each have a magnifier for you. And this is the field magnifier. It's a jeweler's loop that I take out, and biologists take these out a lot, too, so that you can look at the flowers and examine them. So we have yarrow, and I would like for you, too, as it comes to you, look at the structure of the leaf, because when you're out on the prairie, one of the things we talk about is how these plants can't move. They can't go anywhere. So as the sun gets hot and it's brutal out there, they have all these strategies for surviving the sun and drought. And one is the architecture, the design of the leaves. So look at how tiny the leaves are, and look at how it's still able to do everything it has to do, have sex, produce seeds, keep going. And it's really fascinating how all this is weaving together. Like Sylvia mentioning that for the grasses, and I'm going to focus on the grasses because they all flower, but they can't, they're so tiny, they don't attract that many insects. It's the wind that carries their pollen. Okay, so we have yarrow. And you get a yarrow. I dropped this tiny thing. This is a buffalo grass anther. And when it's really coming on, it's like day glow orange. So take a look at that. Let's see. This is dianthus. And again, look at the leaves. It's like a lot of the photosynthesis takes place in the stem. And not to leave out the weeds, I have something that's called Black Medoc, or Medoc, Black Medoc. It's called Black Medoc because it produces a horrific number of tiny black seeds. It's very invasive, and if you want to dislike a plant, if you want to shift and leave the dandelions alone, you could shift to this. But I'm really not advocating that attitude towards any plant.
Okay, so you can send that one around, and then I'll send this one around.
The question was, is it hop clover? So many plants have multiple names, and I don't know all of them. I've never heard that one called hop clover, but it could very well be called that. So please enjoy these little plants. So are you going to run the... Don't do it yet, but... Okay, great.
You have lots of time.
I've just been told I have lots of time. Big mistake. Okay, so I'll just say a little bit about the story of why I came to the conclusion that everybody's ass is grass. I was training as a docent at Kansa Prairie, and we had a person who was an expert in nature interpretation and was telling us all kinds of things about how you should engage people, how you should make sure they have a good time, how you should make nature relevant. Well, so this one person raised her hand and she said, how do you make grass relevant? You know, so you can picture what she was thinking is, here's this prairie, it's all flat, it's grass. There's nothing interesting out here. How are you going to make that interesting? Well, so he didn't have any answers. He drew a blank. I thought, okay, we're all on our own here. And then I had a school group, and it just occurred to me to ask the annoying question, hey, show of hands, everybody. These are probably fourth graders. Who ate grass for breakfast? So let's do that now. Show of hands. Who ate grass for breakfast? See, you guys are just all over this already. I had a waffle. So, you know, all the grasses were totally dependent upon. These are domestic grasses, though. Oats, rice, corn. All of these are grasses. So when I take kids out to the prairie, I say, everybody's dependent on grass. If you eat animals, those animals have eaten grass. We're all consumers of grass at some level. What part of the grass do you eat when you have toast? The seeds, the ground up seeds. Okay, and so we worked really hard to get those plants domesticated so they'd give us really big seeds that we could eat and not have to worry about our source of food. Well, I said, now you're going to go out and you're going to see the wild grasses, all the grasses that have teeny tiny seeds, and they're all jam-packed into the prairie, and they're not domestic, they're wild. And to distinguish them from our crop grasses, the wild grasses don't germinate, don't form their seeds until way late in the season. That's why they, you know, we've harvested everything. June, the combines are out there, and our big wild grasses haven't come on and won't until September, November, and finish their cycle. So, how many people have heard the expression when you were in grade school, your ass is grass? Cool. So you've been threatened with that. Somebody's going to chase you down and rub you into the ground, and you're grass. You're back to earth. You're dead, baby. So how do we get from that threat to... something really positive? There's an author named Martin Prechtel, and he has a series of books. He went to Guatemala. He met the Mayans, and the Mayans have the view that you are the plants that you eat. You know, what you consume, what becomes you, you are it. And I have a necklace. I forgot to wear it today, but it has the face of a Mayan and a corn, a stalk of corn. They are corn. Some of you might have seen Robert Mirabel, the flute player, when he was here. He did this incredible thing in McCain Auditorium. He said, "I'm a farmer. I'm a simple man. I'm a farmer. And I'll show you what my people are, and we've existed for thousands of years because of what we are." And he had a bowl at the edge of the stage. He got the bowl. Inside it was a bag. He took the bag, and he opened it and poured corn into the bowl. Ancient corn, corn that the people have kept going. The necklace that I have on belonged to one of the 13 indigenous grandmothers, Grandmother Flora de Mayo, who has Mayan roots. And she keeps people going around the country and teaching about the little tiny ears of corn that were grown. And they're green. A lot of the kernels are green. They look very, very different, of course, from the monster corn that we grow. But so this association with plants is just the recognition that, isn't it incredible that they sexually reproduce, we sexually reproduce, we're so tied, and I'm really fascinated by the idea of how much genetic material we have in common. Okay, so if you look at how we survive, we are grass. And Martin Prechtel, in his book, shares the Mayan view that only when you're dead and your carcass is planted back in the ground, and they, the traditionalists, bury the person with corn. They'll put corn on your heart. Well, when that corn comes up, you've regenerated. You're back part of the cycle. And they also see that as only when things quiet down and you're gone will what you left really be apparent to people. The stories you told, the love that you left, the gifts that you gave. So that's all part of the cycle. And to me, the flowers, oh my gosh, how brave and adventurous they are, that they just, you know, jump right in there. And I'm going to just show the, it had a soundtrack, some audio, but I don't think we're going to have the audio play. But these are just shots of the prairie. So I want you to enjoy the mix, the complexity that we're all a part of. Yeah, I'll stay here and, oh, yeah, since there isn't music. Flax, grooved flax, pitcher sage, more pitcher sage. Flowering grass, big blue stem. Moss also flowers. This is hairy grandma. Those are the anthers. Penstemon, cobaea. Penstemon cobaea with wild alfalfa, some milkweed in the corner, some out-of-focus yarrow, a bird's nest, a meadowlark, spider milkweed, Showy primrose. Slim pod Venus's looking glass. Butterfly milkweed. Okay, thanks.
We'll wait a second as technology catches up with humanity. My mother's garden. Anyone who's visited my home here in Manhattan knows that my gardens hold an abundance of life. Mostly I have perennials, spring bulbs of narcissus and tulips, there followed by iris and peonies and hostas and daylilies and coneflowers and daisies, along with my herb garden and a few annuals. Being a gay man, I have to plant pansies every spring. And they're followed by marigolds and petunias for the summer months. There's some grasses, some shrubs that contribute color and textures. In every house I've lived since I left my childhood home up in Beatty, up in Marshall County, about 50 miles north here, I've left behind plant life. Sometimes it's just been one or two plants, and sometimes I've done a total, complete redesign of the yard, often not telling my landlord I was doing it. I've always wanted to see nature bloom around me. Several threads come together to weave the tapestry that has become my garden, and the first is my mother, Ollie Mae Campbell. She was born in Blackie, Kentucky, in Lecture County. She was the second of 12 children. Life was hard in Kentucky, especially the Kentucky coal country of the 1930s. Most of my mother's childhood, there was never sufficient food in the house to feed all the children. And my mother's stepfather had bouts of depression when he wasn't working in the coal mines, which often left the family destitute. So children were farmed out. They were sent to other family members, and my mother spent most of the 1930s with her grandparents, her maternal grandparents, who had a little bit more than her own parents did. And the one thing my mother talked the most about was the flowers that my maternal grandmother would have in her yard. In 1959, my parents bought a small house a half block south of the Catholic Church in Beatty. It was the first property they had ever owned. I remember for the first couple of years, my mother turned half the city lot the house sat on into this huge vegetable garden, stretching from the street all the way to the back alley. There was corn and beans and peas and eggplant and cabbage and lettuce and radishes and cantaloupe and onions and tomatoes and cucumbers and much more, potatoes in particular. Partly because of the hunger she endured in her youth, and partly because my mother would never spend a penny unless she absolutely had to, my mother made sure that there was food for the winter. She canned and canned and canned green beans and tomatoes and tomato juice and numerous kinds of pickles. There was lime pickles, bread and butter pickles, sweet dill pickles, hot dill pickles, all sorts of pickles, sauerkraut, pickled beets, chow chow, corn relish, applesauce, and apples for pies. My mother died in 1997, and my sister and I undertook to clean out the summer kitchen, as it was referred to, in the basement of my parents' home. We found that while even fighting cancer in the last year of her life, she still had put up green beans, pickled beets, and bread and butter pickles in 1996. I served the last of her pickled beets at Thanksgiving in 1998. My parents built a new home in 1964, and this greatly reduced my mother's vegetable garden. There was numerous discussions between my father and mother about the size of the vegetable garden was going to be with the new house. And still, although all through my youth, each spring the earth would be spaded and prepared for another planting season. But in addition to beans and corn and tomatoes and onions and lettuce and potatoes and asparagus, about a quarter of the garden space was devoted to flowers. My mother had finally reached the point where she had money in the bank, so she planted some roses, which she tended with great care, along with asters and petunias and sweet pea, and geraniums. The geraniums in particular are interesting because they're a plant of resurrection. My mother would pull up the geraniums every fall before the frost. She would hang them upside down in the garage with a plastic bag around their roots, and then she would replant them in the spring, and they would return to life to be appreciated for another summer. Today, we just sort of throw them away. Growing up in an agricultural community, I learned early on the importance of the seasons and became aware of the rhythm of the seasons had on nature around me. I was taught that getting my hands dirty by planting things was something good. As I got older, that rhythm of the seasons also dictated what was going on in my life as I worked for a farmer in Beatty. The first cutting of alfalfa was in June. That meant baling and putting up the nature's abundance for the lean months of winter. If it was the 4th of July, well, then I was sitting in a truck hauling in wheat. In July and August, we prayed for rain, and there would be a second and third cutting of alfalfa and more bales to be put into barns. If I wasn't throwing bales, then I was walking the corn rows and the milo rows, cutting cane out of them. The first plant that I could ever call my own was given to me by my aunt. It was a cactus, it still is alive today, that she had been growing for many years. On a visit one summer, it was in bloom, and I was taken by the fragrance, and I still am. I don't know anything quite like the fragrance that this bloom gives off. Although I lost part of it when I had to transplant it out of the cream separator's top that my mother had planted it in some 15 years ago, if my memory is correct, I got this plant before I ever entered high school, so I'm guesstimating that my portion down here in the lower picture is around 45 years old. It occasionally still blooms, but nothing like that top picture. That was one my mother sent me when I was living in Italy. I guess my mother took better care of it than I do. I just sort of pour water on it and hope it makes it through. The second influence on me and plants was the civil rights activist and social critic Dick Gregory, who I heard speak in 1974 in addressing a Roman Catholic youth conference. Gregory challenged us to look beyond the limits of the abortion debate, which was framed as the termination of life. Life, he said, was more than just human. Life included animals and plants, and for all we knew, aliens in space. If we were going to be quote-unquote pro-life, then how could we be quote-unquote pro-death by supporting capital punishment or ripping plants up by their roots so we could eat them? Even worse was the conditions in which the farm workers were being kept and the way they were treated as they harvested the food that was sitting on us and the plates in front of us. Now, I'm not sure that the Roman Catholic hierarchy knew that Gregory was going to say, and I rather doubt that they were planning on affirming the seventh principle of the Unitarian Universalist beliefs, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are part. But that is the lesson I learned from his speech, and I left that experience a confirmed environmentalist, and I remain so today. Which brings me to the final chapter of how plants have raised me. In part, as a result of globalization and the industrialization of food production in the United States and that model we export out to the world, and the environmental degradation, of course, that approach brings, in Italy in the late 1980s, a group of leftists came together to celebrate how food had been traditionally produced in and around the Piemontese village of Bra. Today, this movement is known as Slow Food, and I'm proud to say I've been a part of it since the very beginning. I was introduced to this movement through the pages of a newspaper called El Manifesto and a little supplement that was called the Gamberetto Rosso, the Little Red Shrimp. At the time, I was renting a 6-acre farm 2 hours south of Naples. That's the coast I lived on. And I had some 30 olive trees, so I made my own olive oil. I had all sorts of fruit trees. I had lemon trees, orange trees, mandarin trees. And I had land to grow my own vegetables. I produced tomatoes and eggplant and peppers in the summer, broccoli and cabbage in the fall, artichokes and fennel in the spring, and then green beans and herbs of an abundance. I also had grapes. I had apple trees. I had peach trees. It was a great little place to be. Slow food, as they would say, is first of all good. A tomato tastes like a tomato should. If you go into Dillon's and you buy any of those tomatoes shipped here from California, they have absolutely no taste at all. There's no genetically modified organisms, and there's not an intense farming method in the production of the food. In short, the way food is produced respects the environment, animal welfare, and our own health. It has to be fair, meaning that food is at accessible prices for consumers and fair conditions and pay for small-scale producers. Slow food works to cut out the middle distribution layers where profit is made, and it also works to reduce the food miles. The average food miles, our products here in the United States, is 1,400 miles. That, if you like Heinz ketchup is a particular interesting one. Tomatoes are grown in California. They're shipped to Canada to be turned into ketchup, and then they're sent back to the United States, either to California or their distribution center on the East Coast, from which they're shipped out to our grocery stores. That's a lot of shipping for a bottle of ketchup. So the important thing about slow food is that consumers and producers know each other. You build a relationship with the people you buy your products from if you can't produce your own. This approach is often dismissed by the corporate moneymakers who care little about the environment or the welfare of human, animal, and plant life. However, something interesting is last fall, the United Nations issued a report in which they said the model being put forth by slow food is probably the only way we're going to actually be able to feed the human population of the planet in the near future. The mega corporate farming methods that we're using here in Kansas don't really produce food we can eat. They produce grains that are fed to animals, which are then butchered, and we eat that protein. So we have to start rethinking how we're going to do that. On the other hand, today I don't produce much of my own food as I once did. Other than some tomatoes, my garden today is filled with flowers, which bring beauty to my neighborhood and a lot of contentment to myself. I have close to 300 varieties of daylilies, 20-some types of iris. I have various types of hostas and other plants. I spend most of the summer tending to my garden and continuing on the tradition that my mother taught to me. I still have several plants that were my mother's. These are some examples of my daylilies. In that slide on the far left there, you have an asparagus fern, and I call it a spider plant. I don't really know if that's what it is, and airplane plants. And those were all plants my mother grew. And so what's fun about them is I have them on my patio through the summer, and then in the fall I drag them in. My living room becomes a greenhouse. It's not used for anything else but plant life most of the winter. I'm guessing the spider plant is around 35 years old. My mother had the asparagus fern when I was a child. I just turned 59, so I'm guessing that it's 50-some years old at least. And they provide a living connection to the people who are no longer with me and remind me daily of the interconnected web of life that we belong to. I don't often grow baby deer. But 2 summers ago, I went out one morning to look at my daylilies, and lo and behold, that's what I found underneath a daylily bush. And it was there through the morning, and finally around 1 o'clock in the afternoon, the mother showed up to pick up her little baby, and off they went into the woods. So that's really a unique crop I grew there. Marion Quinlan, who's a friend of this fellowship, taught me about daylilies. I have lots of daylilies. They are beautiful, they require little care, and they provide an ever-changing garden from May through July. Daylily blooms last only a day, irregardless of their beauty. So often, we just assume that what's here today will be here tomorrow. But that's not the case. Life is very fragile. Our planet is fragile. And we only get one shot. Was that my last one? That was the end of the slides. Good. Only get one shot at doing it right, especially when it comes to our environment. I think that's the most important thing that we walk away with today, is the growing concern for the environment. I've been hearing this ever since I was a small child. And it's worse today than it was when I was a child 50 years ago. We have to start getting something right, or the environment we live in will not be able to support us.
Thanks, Jessica. Oh my gosh, presented, you blew me away. That was amazing. I have so much to think about. And so we have at least five minutes for comments. Diane has to make an announcement. Okay. Oh, Mondo. I'm so sorry.
While she's coming up, tonight is the annual wildflower walk on Kanza Prairie. So if you come back to the barn and register, we take you for a two-hour tour of all the flowers that are in bloom now and the grasses and everything. Thanks.
First of all, I'm going to tell you a little story. I grew up in a small town on the shores of Puget Sound, and we had a holiday there. This was in the 1930s, and the holiday was called May Day, and it was devoted primarily to singing and dancing. The whole school did it. We did maypoles on the school lawn, very small town, so everybody participated. And I thought that was a wonderful, wonderful holiday at a time when all the flowers were blooming. But it got waylaid by politics in the 40s, late 40s, after World War II, and we don't have it anymore. It disappeared. And with it, our flower festival. So today, we are going to do a little project to kind of reinvent that without a maypole, because it's a lot of work and stuff like that. And we are going to use flowers to paint, so to speak, a design on a, so to speak, canvas on the floor in Inez's old room there. And I want everybody to take a flower. There are lots of flowers around. Everybody brought beautiful flowers. And some of them are wild, and some of them are very tame. And also remember, though, that flowers sometimes have thorns, such as roses, prickly poppies, and they're gorgeous flowers, but watch out. I didn't bring any poisonous ones, like poison ivy, which has a beautiful flower, nor anything like that. I didn't bring stinging nettles, you know. So, and other people brought flowers too, and I think everybody may take a flower or two or three or a whole bouquet home with them. Now, flowers, to me, are the an ephemeral stage of the plant life cycle. So we can't just look at the flower. We should be also celebrating what it becomes, because our lives depend on them. And so that's really all I have to say. And I think Sylvia has something. And when you get your coffee, gravitate and pick up a flower.
Oh, sorry, my time was... How could you forget this? This is the crowning thing of our whole program. So we're all going to take a picture of what we create in the 20 minutes after the program. And then we'll take home what you will, and then we'll recycle them back to nature. Does anyone have something to share? A flower story or? Oh, thanks, Austin.
My name is Kathy Hedge, and I have a dear friend, my sweetheart now, but in 1986 is when we first met, and we used to have parties at my house for my writing group, and we called it our movie nights, and we'd watch a movie, and then we'd all critique it together and say what we loved about it. But Mark would always bring flowers, and every time I'd see him at the door with his big bouquet of flowers, a big smile, I just thought, oh, I really like this man. But I thought he was at least 10 or 15 years younger than I was, so I never flirted with him. Well, so as the years went by, we still stayed really good friends and then became sweethearts. And still, most of the 18 years that we've been together, I have flowers on my dining room table, and they last longer than any flowers I've ever had. Long-stemmed red roses will last for 3 weeks if he brings them to me.
Symbol of enduring love.
Growing up in California, your dandelion talk reminded me of this. We'd often just go to the park, you know, the family, four kids, you spread out a blanket and you play. But we would always look for a part of the park, which wasn't too hard to find, that was infested with dandelions, because that gave us things to play with. You know, was this a California thing, or do you take off the flower and you put it under your chin to see if you like butter? All right, so that's a universal thing. We also would make... necklaces out of the dandelions. So those dandelions kept us busy for hours and hours.
Jim Chanteau, I had the good fortune about 5 years ago to go to a visit to the Galapagos Islands out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, made famous by Darwin's visit. But one of the things I observed there and was able to confirm later, all of the flowers on the Galapagos Islands are yellow. Huh. And the reason is they only have one kind of bee, and that bee likes that color yellow. And so all of the flowers and all of the plants have turned that yellow in order to attract that particular type of bee. Wonderful interrelationship.
It's interesting. Kalina? Oh, whoops. Jennifer?
My mother's first cousin, the late Joe May, who was basically a living version of Boo Radley, cultivated a daylily that he named after their grandmother. And my mother's grandmother died on my mother's 16th birthday, and she went to visit her. Anyway, Joe named this daylily version Mama Hallie. And for years and years, the first daylily of the season, she just kept the Mama Hallie, would open on my mother's birthday, May 27th.
Wow. I think one last comment over here. Kalina.
Kalina Stanton. When I turned 16, my brother was in Vietnam in the service, and that was when we would talk to him. We'd go, over, out, however he did that. So it was a major event trying to visit with him when he was overseas. But on my 16th birthday, the van pulled up from the greenhouse and the long box, and I just knew it was for me because it was my birthday. And I unwrapped this gorgeous package, and there were 16 long-stemmed dandelions.
Okay, go for it, Enel. We can skip the hymn. Does Enel has a comment?
Sorry.
I grew up, of course, in Mexico, and, of course, flowers everywhere, every corner. Bent grew up in Amsterdam with flowers everywhere. So whenever we went to the farmer's market, we first purchased our flowers. Then what we had left, we bought our vegetables.
Okay, thanks. Much rather hear all the comments, and we can sing that song another day. Just have some closing. That was wonderful, everyone. I'm sure you have more to say. We can continue over coffee. And I forgot to invite visitors, if we have any visitors, to introduce yourself. Do we have any visitors? Or to sign our guest book by the front door. I'm going to read for you a modification of poem number 5 by E.E. Cummings. Oh, sweet spontaneous earth, how often have the doting fingers of purient philosophers pinched and poked your flowers? Has the naughty thumb of science prodded your blossoms? How often have religions taken your blooms upon their scraggy knees, squeezing and buffeting them that you might conceive gods? But true to the incomparable couch of death, your rhythmic lover, you answer them only with fields of flowers. Thank you, everyone, for coming and for our special presenters and your comments. Go make your ephemeral flower art in the Alsop room and enjoy some coffee.